supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got another one of those jam-packed shows for you cats and kittens. At the end of the show and the question of the week, we're going to talk about the last cut of the season on your lawn. Should you cut a little lower to prevent matting and snow mold, or what should you do? We're also going to talk to Karen Snetzlar from the Wagner Free Institute of Science about her upcoming free series of classes that's going to merge sustainability and invasive plants. How intriguing. So we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Barbara, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. This is Barbara from Marietta, Georgia.
Well, how are you, Barb? I hear about Marietta, Georgia. I don't know, we've had a call from there. You're famous for something, right?
We have the big chicken in Marietta, Georgia.
How big is your chicken?
It's about 4 stories tall.
Are you serious?
Serious.
So this was or is a great producer of chickens, the town?
Yes.
Okay. I'll have to investigate the giant chicken of Marietta, Georgia. All right. What can we do for Barb?
I have English ivy, a lot of it. I have a half-acre property, and probably 3/4 to 4/5 of it is English ivy. And for 22 years since I planted it, I have been hand trimming it. And the only advice I have locally, it grows about 1 foot a month. The only advice I get locally on a way to control it is to use Roundup. And I wanted your advice on that because you have the organic emphasis. And I refuse to use Roundup because it's such a horrible neurotoxin. So I'm wondering how you recommend to control the borders. I have probably 1 mile of borders that I'm hand trimming.
Well, first of all, thank you for your turning down of the chemical herbicide. It's dangerous for you, too. There's been evidence that suggests it's a human hormonal disruptor. So there's lots of good reasons not to use it. One of the best reasons is also something you should know instinctively from getting close up and personal with your ivy for so many years. The waxy leaves of ivy really repel any kind of an herbicide or any kind of an agent that's sprayed on them.
Oh, how about that? I didn't think of that.
These things are called broadleaf herbicides because they work best on weeds that have broad leaves, to hold the herbicide, whereby, you know, grass has a blade shooting up and, you know, it doesn't stick as much. So now, you deliberately planted this as a ground cover, correct?
Yes.
And you do like it covering certain areas of ground.
I do. Plus, I have a hillside home, and it helps prevent soil erosion.
I can't imagine how much soil you've protected by having something that tenacious and, quote, easy care. Isn't it easy care, Bart?
Yeah, I had no idea the work I was getting myself into. It takes a minimum of 2 hours a day, 4 days a week over these 22 years. So,
and we ain't getting any younger, are we?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. There's a couple of big projects I do physically that I'm thinking of farming out in future years. So have you tried doing this mechanically? Have you tried mowing the edges or using a weed whacker to control the edges?
Well, if I mow the edges, it'll take the leaves off, but the vine, the woody vine, will continue to grow. So I haven't used that. And I don't know if there are different species of English ivy, but as far as using a weed whacker, that wouldn't work because the vine gets so woody that the weed whacker would never be able to chop into it.
Well, how about edging? How about driving some edging in and actually confining it, at least on some sides, where it's just kind of growing into areas you don't want? some really good strong edging could save your hands and your back.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And obviously, yeah. you know, it's still going to try to get up to the top, but that would give you a lot of wiggle room. And, you know, it's much easier to take it down when it's up high than it is to push it out of the ground that's already cultivated.
Yeah, true.
And you may not have gotten English ivy. If you go to our website and you read the A to Z articles under I for ivy, The American Ivy Society, which is also a great resource, by the way, I urge you to go to their website.
All right, thanks.
They mention that a lot of so-called English ivy is actually Irish ivy or Virginia creeper or other kind of vining plants, and that English ivy tends to be much better behaved than some of these. Anything with Irish in the name, you know, is going to misbehave. So I predict you might have the Irish ivy. So, you know,
okay.
Put up some edging, keep the pubs open later. Keep it distracted.
All right,
Barb?
Thanks so much. Thanks,
all right.
Mike.
Good luck.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Rob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, how are you?
I am doing well, Rob. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
And where is Rob doing great?
Well, I have a cabin up in Beach Creek, Pennsylvania.
Beach Creek, Pennsylvania. Where might that be?
Well, it's in north central Pennsylvania, just above State College.
Oh, okay. So you're one of our State College listeners?
Well, actually, I live in Philadelphia, but this cabin is actually in that area. So
you
the call's related to that area.
You can listen to us twice because we're in the air in State College, too.
I actually do. A lot of times when I'm driving up to Beach Creek, I do listen to the public station.
Okay. So what's going on? And this call relates to your cabin. Is this where you escape in the summertime?
Yeah. What I'd like to do is I'd like to plant some clover there for the wildlife and the deer. The soil is fairly mountainous, and I was just wondering if you could give me any advice in that area.
Do deer eat clover?
I believe that they do, and the reason I say that is there was a gas line that kind of went through that area, and for whatever reason, they planted clover there. And when we go spotting for deer, we tend to see a lot of the deer in that particular area.
I know planting clover would be very good for the bee population, both any beekeepers who live near you and all the different native bees. But, Rob, if you want to feed deer, you would plant arborvitae and azaleas and rhododendrons and tulips, man. They love tulips.
Well, those are all great suggestions.
Boy, you know, this is, have we ever had in 15 years a call about feeding deer as opposed to doing the opposite to deer? But, you know, the one interesting thing about the plant that you've chosen, first of all, it'll be beautiful. You know, there's all different kinds of clover. You probably saw the white clover, right?
Well, the clover that I saw is similar to what you might see in your yard when clover grows.
Right, which is typically white clover, but there is also red clover, which I believe is a perennial. And then there's the Tommy James and the Shondell song. There is actually crimson clover. And these are all interesting plants. First of all, I don't think you're going to have a lot of trouble getting them established because these are plants that tend to gravitate towards poor soil. This is where you can really get anthropomorphic with gardening because it's almost like somehow the clover knows the soil needs improvement. So somehow it manages to reach this area of poor soil. And then as the clover grows, it connects with different microorganisms in the soil and forms a symbiotic relationship that allows the clover to pull plant-feeding nitrogen out of the air. Clover is a legume, a nitrogen-fixing legume, that actually not only feeds itself, but when it dies back at the end of the season, returns some of that nitrogen to the soil. So I think all that you'll need to do is decide which kind of clover you want to plant. And, you know, if you go to our website, go to You Bet Your Garden, go to Garden Answers A to Z, we did a little primer on cover crops that talks about the different kinds of clover.
Okay.
You, I would think, you'd want to plant a perennial clover, right?
Yeah, that would be great.
So it would come back year after year. And I believe those are the really colorful ones. I mean, a field of white is interesting enough, but I would love to, you know, a field of crimson clover. I mean, you know, that's turn on the 60s music real loud. What I would do is I would sow the clover on, quote, your bare soil, and then just cover it with like half an inch of whatever you can find. Cheaply, what you know, whether it's topsoil or compost or aged mushroom soil. And then I think in the springtime, you know, time it right before a rain, pick a, you know, or maybe just do all, maybe do all the clovers, you know, maybe try them all out, see which one works the best. But it's it will definitely be good for your bee population, and they're the ones who need the help the most.
Well, I'm definitely going to try it, and I want to thank you for you know having me on the show. I just want to say I really like your show, and I think it's very informative, and again, I appreciate your help.
Well, thank you, Rob. Enjoy your time at the cabin next summer.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that we're getting close to last call for Cuba. There are still a few openings left in the tour I'll be leading to investigate the botanical delights of Cuba and just maybe enjoy their average 80 to 85 degree daytime winter temperatures from January 14th to the 22nd. But time is running out for you to make the choice of exploring a tropical paradise with me or breaking up ice dams on your roof. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the way to mow for the last cut of the season, invasive plants in sustainable gardens, and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up, should the last cut of the year be low to protect your lawn against matting and snow mold? We'll let you know when we get to the question of the week. We'll also take lots more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Professor Karen Snetzlar, who is the professor and chair of the biology department at St. Joseph University. But more importantly for our methods today, she is one of the lecturers at a great place in Philadelphia called the Wagner Free Institute of Science. And every year, they do these things that are essentially college classes in conjunction with other area facilities. And Karen, you've been doing these botany classes for, you said, 12 years now?
I think so, something like that. It's been a long time.
We've had you on several times in the past. And these are free classes. I mean, you essentially get a little mini college class education. They're going to be held at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society headquarters. That's your partner in this in this endeavor. And it's going to be on one Tuesday and then five Mondays in January and February. We'll have all that information up on our website. Now, this year's botany lecture is going to be very different. You're going to tackle the thorny issue of so-called invasive plants. And, of course, you're calling wild things towards a more sustainable natural garden. So tell us what your plans are here.
Well, usually I do more straight-up science for this because that's kind of my thing. I'm a botanist, but I'm a trained biologist. But a couple years ago, we actually did a course on strictly on invasive plants. And we looked at it from a scientific point of view, what makes a plant invasive. And it wasn't just a list of the invasive plants. But I realized that people are very afraid. And some of the gardeners really hate certain plants. And that doesn't seem right to me. I think everyone should really like plants. So the idea is to try to demystify invasive plants a little bit so people aren't afraid to let things grow in their gardens if they don't know what they are.
Now, I was just at a wonderful event at the Wagner Free Institute of Science where you feted our Derek Pitts from the Franklin Institute, gave him an honorary doctorate. And I really got to see the Wagner Free Institute of Science, which is a time capsule. It is a Victorian museum that was correctly assembled right around the turn of the century and then has simply been kept clean and in good working order. But it is a Victorian museum.
Right. They say it's a museum of a museum. So it's really like taking a step back in time.
But one of the things it shows us is traveling through time. Nature has never been static. We're seeing all these animals replacing animals and plants replacing plants and sea creatures replacing sea creatures. You know, with this whole issue of invasive plants, how much of this can be attributed to nature, to natural selection?
Well, I think it depends on what you consider to be nature. And that's really been a change in our thinking that's come about over the past, it's really the past 20 years or so. It's sort of been building. You know, we're a part of nature, and humans are a part of nature. And I think we just have to own up to that and say that there isn't very much on the planet that we haven't affected right now. And so, you know, we need to take responsibility and also enjoy being a part of it. So I think that's one of the things I'm trying to get at with the course is, yes, invasive plants can be a challenge, but we're going to have to live with them. So I don't think we should hate them.
So how will you approach this? How are you going to study them with your students?
Right. So the first thing I think we'll do is talk about why we have lawns and flower beds the way that we do and just try to think about the history and sort of the social things behind that as well. A lawn is a very social thing. I think it's not just about tradition, but it also goes to sort of the commons, you know, your neighbors. You do things in your yard because you want to make your neighbors happy and you want to, you know, fit in and all that. So those lawns serve a very important function for us. But there are other possibilities. And so I think if people want to reduce maybe chemical inputs on their properties and maybe have a little bit wilder areas, they shouldn't be afraid to do that. I seem to run across people that are afraid not to mow because some invasive plant will get started and maybe it'll be the end of the world and it'll be their fault. And I just, you know, it's not going to be your fault.
Oh, no, they're everywhere already.
And some are worse than others. So I think education is really important. You can some invasives, you pull them every couple years and you'll keep them under control that way. But I think having a little bit wilder, more diverse kind of place could be better for animals, better for other creatures that we share the planet with. So that's a piece of it, is trying to think beyond just plants, but also thinking about a bigger picture.
In the past, you've done topics like pollination, right? How flowers attract different kinds of insects and pollinators and that's pretty straightforward instructional.
Right, or plant physiology for gardeners. I've done, I think, a couple times, or tropical botany, things like that. So this is a little different.
Do you expect any kind of confrontation here?
Well, when we did invasive plants, there was a bit of controversy about native versus non-native plants, and some folks think we shouldn't plant anything but native plants. And we explored that a little bit. That gets a little tricky, and I think maybe there's been a little too much focus on, vilifying of plants that we don't consider to be native.
Well, are there really people out there planting invasive plants, or aren't these so-called invasive plants just really good adapters, really good at surviving? Things like honeysuckle that just show up, or purple loosestrife that just enchant you. Yes, they're on a list of bad plants, but my God, the smell in the middle of summertime, or that beautiful sheen of purple that goes on forever, that's filled with bees and insects. Some of these things that just show up can be so seductive.
It's true. It's really difficult. Some of the plants now that we can't imagine bamboo, that someone planted that, and you know, it's so invasive. But they do have appealing qualities. Otherwise, we wouldn't plant them. And it's also tricky because we don't always know, or we almost never know which ones are going to become invasive and which ones aren't. So sometimes things that don't seem to cause problems for 20 or 30 or 40 years, all at once, maybe the temperature goes up a little bit, maybe there's a little more CO2, who knows, and they may take a turn for the worse.
I will tell you that the first couple of years I gardened, I assiduously pulled every weed. And then one year, I forget what happened, I got distracted and let some mullein get out of hand. And now it is one of my favorite plants. I'm always looking for that rosette the first year, those furry lamb's ear leaves, knowing that the next season it's going to send up this stalk that'll be 3, 4, 5, 6 foot tall, covered with these little yellow flowers, sulfurous flowers that attract all kinds of insects. And I'm not ashamed to say I can't grow anything that magnificent intentionally.
Right, and it's free. All you had to do was not pull it up. There you have this beautiful plant that came in. It's fun.
So do you think that's one of the things you're going to try to be coming to grips with in this class, is which are the things that simply need to be thinned out a little bit and treated like regular plants, and which are the things that you really have to be cautious about and not let into your landscape?
Right, and I think it's also going to matter. It's going to make a difference what kind of an individual we're dealing with, too. Some people are more controlling than others, and so they'll want to be more circumspect about what plants they let in.
Do you think you're going to start seeing people sitting on opposite sides of the room here? Is this going to be a red-blue kind of lecture?
Yeah, I don't know. It'd be interesting. There may be some controversy around it. The invasive plants do seem to generate very strong opinions sometimes.
And so in this case, I'm sensing you're going to be more of a moderator even than a strict instructor as you've been in the past.
Well, I've always welcomed discussion, but the group is pretty large, and so we do have to rein it in a little bit. So it works out really well. I tell them up front that if you want to comment and I don't see you, it may be because I just feel like we need to move along at this point so that we can get to the end of our syllabus.
And when you get to the end of the syllabus, last night, do you get a diploma or anything?
Well, they can get a diploma, yes. You can actually get a certificate of completion. So students who are members of the Wagner Free Institute get a free certificate, and otherwise there's a small fee to get the certificate of completion if you do all the homework.
If you do, there's homework involved, huh?
I'll have to decide whether there's homework or quizzes this year.
All right,
we'll see.
I'm pulling back my registration. Professor Karen Snetzlar will be teaching a free class called Wild Things Towards a More Sustainable Natural Garden for the Wagner Free Institute of Science. The classes will be held at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society headquarters at 20th and Art Streets in Philadelphia. It starts on Tuesday, January 21st, and then it moves to the next 5 Mondays. The class is free, but pre-registration is required. And don't delay, because they started taking registrations on Tuesday, December 3rd. So we'll have all the information up at our website. These classes are just amazing. What a special treat for people in our area to have this opportunity. Thank you for doing them, and thank the Wagner Free Institute of Science.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on the show.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sandra, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, and I want to thank you for your excellent advice.
Well, thank you, Sandra. How nice of you to say. Where are you?
Chester Springs.
In Pennsylvania?
Correct.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Sandra in Chester Springs?
Well, I recently moved into my new home and planted shrubs in a neglected lawn area, and I discovered that there are roughly 5 to 6 grubs per 18 inches of what I was digging up. And I remember you said to put mulch around your new plants. Now, I only put a minimum around the root ball. My question is, if I expand the mulch, am I giving winter protection to the grubs?
Okay, so you had an old ratty lawn, and you decided to put some perennials in instead. And when you were digging the holes, you found grubs in the soil.
Yes.
White crescent-shaped creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And these will grow up to be adult beetles, sometimes Japanese beetles, sometimes rose chafer beetles, sometimes June beetles, but all members of what's called the scarab beetle family. The grubs look somewhat similar. Now, I'll put this as delicately as possible, Sandra. Did you squish the ones you saw?
You bet I did.
Okay, good for you. And now you say you have mulched them. What kind of mulch did you use?
Shredded mulch. I think cedar.
Okay, so you went out and bought wood mulch.
Yes.
Okay. Well, cedar is probably the best of a bad lot. And you said you didn't spread it too thickly, right?
No, I didn't expect, I kept it, like you said, 2 or 3 inches thick, but I didn't go past the root ball just in case I was making the grubs happy.
Okay. I want you to actually go out with a ruler, and I want you to level it out so it's not any deeper than 2 inches.
All right.
I read all these extension bulletins, and I read all these gardening books and articles, and people just pile on the mulch. And the truth is that once you get past 2 inches, mulch then begins to have the capacity to shed rainwater, to prevent rainwater from getting to the roots of your soil. So people who pile on thick amounts of mulch, thinking they're going to keep moisture in the soil, might actually be preventing moisture from actually ever getting into the soil. Now, is your mulch touching the plants?
No.
Okay. And is it near a light-colored home or car?
No, that's sort of out in the field.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then that's probably a perfectly appropriate use, although I would have preferred that you shred up a lot of your fall leaves and use that as a more natural mulch.
Oh.
Now, the good news and the bad news is that nothing you did with either covering the surface of the soil or not covering the surface of the soil was going to affect any remaining grubs. What happens is the female beetles, it's always the females who cause problems in all of nature. The female beetles lay their eggs in ratty lawns, lawns that are cut low or have bare spots, because it's very easy. And then the eggs hatch and go through what are called a series of instars. You wouldn't even recognize the grubs when they first come out of the egg. They're like a grain of rice. But then they molt and they get bigger and bigger. And all this time they are feeding on the roots of the grass. Now, I don't think that grubs cross over to feed on any other kind of roots. So they're not down there mulching the roots of your perennials now.
Oh, good.
And as the weather gets cold, any surviving grubs, the ones who escaped your tender mercies, they're moving further, deeper down into the soil. And then in the spring, what will happen is the reverse. As the soil begins to warm, the grubs will move up towards the surface of the soil. And then just as they get close to the surface, I believe, they'll go through their complete metamorphosis. And instead of being this white crescent-shaped globby thing, they will emerge as a scarab beetle, all of which are plant eaters. So do you have roses in your landscape?
No. I only saw two Japanese beetles the whole summer.
Oh, okay. So you must have had strangers coming to your house to lay to lay their eggs. Either that or that was the one spot. So I would not worry about it. Are you going to try to rehab some parts of the lawn?
Yes, I was wondering what to do.
Well, right now, do nothing, you know, because obviously everything is frozen. Then in the spring, you know, really the smart advice in a climate like ours in the Northeast is just to make sure the lawn is never cut lower than 3 inches. Mm-hmm. If you water it over the summer, water it deeply and infrequently, like for hours, once a week, and then really assess it in mid-August. If it looks pretty good, then you just give it a feeding and continue with that. If there's bare spots or ratty spots, you may want to replant it or overseed it. But the time to do that is in August. And you said you just moved into a new place. So, you know, probably more important to get those perennials in the ground. But if you have a nice high cut and you water the lawn deeply, the lawn won't be inviting to beetle grubs again. And you may not, you may have gotten all the grubs. Who knows?
Excellent.
All right.
All right. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Sandra. You have a good winter.
You too, then. Bye-bye.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn everybody who gets a pre-cut Christmas tree that the secret to having a needle-free floor over the holidays is hydration, hydration, hydration. First, make sure the branches are supple and not stiff before you buy. Then cut an extra inch off the bottom of the trunk when you get it home and place the recut trunk in a big bucket of water for 24 hours before you put the tree in its stand. But don't go looking for all the details in the A to Z Answers section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and answers to that eternal question at the end of the season, how low should you mow? I'm Lowdown Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Should you cut your lawn low going into the winter to prevent problems, or will that simply cause problems? We'll answer that burning, or maybe it's a freezing question, after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Sal, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Sal. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well also.
And where is Sal doing well?
I'm in Manahawkin, New Jersey, the gateway to Long Beach Island.
Oh, there you go. Did you get beat up by Sandy?
Not myself, but a couple of close friends did.
Yeah, that's good. So you say Long Beach Island. That, to me, is like one of the ground zeros for that destruction.
It really was. My big question is, 3 fall seasons ago, being Italian, I've always wanted a fig tree, and I purchased a mission fig in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
I planted it then, and the first season, summer, I didn't do anything to it, and I wanted it to just grow and see what was going on. And I got a lot of foliage and 3 very nice-sized figs. So it grows pretty fast. This summer, it grew an immense amount, and I got 23 very, very nice figs.
So, Sal, you're counting every fig, right? You got them out on the table, and you're making little check marks and everything.
Well, it just so happens that my son and I we just do that. You
right.
Know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question is, I don't really know, and I cannot get accurate information on what to do and when do I trim this.
Okay, so far you haven't touched it, right?
No, I have not touched it. I've let it go natural, but boy, those things grow fast. I guess I have a good location for it.
Well, I don't know if you have a good location or not. Is it close to a house or a structure?
No, it's not.
How much winter dieback occurs?
Not much at all.
Not much at all. Okay. Well, the 2 things could be happening. One is it might need some winter protection, or the other is everything's fine. And what's the next exponential thing? Are you a math major here, Sal? First year we had 3, next year we had 23. What are we up for? 252? Is that, you know?
Well, I just want to increase the yield and improve on the shape of it.
The issue with figs is they are Mediterranean plants. It does get a little too cold for them in many locations. Now, you, however, you're pretty close to the ocean still, right?
4 miles away.
Yeah, so your climate is somewhat moderated by that. I'll tell you what, it's up to you. If you want to, quote, wrap your fig, you can go online. I mean, there's people who build houses around their fig trees who actually...
I know, they put burlap and everything.
What I recommend is if you want to do something like that is you do pound some tall stakes or pieces of wood into the ground and then wrap burlap around that, but not around the tree itself. That, to me, is asking for trouble. All you want to do is break that fierce wind that you guys can sometimes get. You're always going to get some winter dieback. By the way, the other option, the true Italian option, since you mentioned that is your background, you might want to think about this next year, is sometime in like September or October after you've harvested your figs.
Yes.
You dig a trench next to the tree.
Okay.
You rock the roots of the tree out of the ground, push the tree down into this trench, cover it with old carpeting and dirt, and make sure the roots are completely covered in soil. And then in the spring, you revive it. You lift it up again. It's like the story of Easter. And you replant it. And with it having been buried in the soil, there's no winter dieback. And that's when not only do you get the most figs, you may get 2 crops.
Wow.
In the same year. That's what the real Italians do is they, if you've ever heard the term, burying their fig as opposed to wrapping it. So that's something cool for you to think about doing next year. This year.
But when do you prune it?
In the spring after new growth begins. You will see new growth appear.
Okay.
So you wait like 2 weeks, and then you can prune it for shape, but very important to prune off any winter-damaged parts. Like, you know, some of the branches will have turned black over winter, and they'll no longer be vibrant. You want to prune those off, but you want to wait like 2 weeks after it starts growing, just because there could be a late freeze.
Right. After it starts leafing out.
After it starts leafing out, you count 2 weeks, and then you can prune it. And as you've noted, these figs just grow tremendously fast once the season warms up.
Okay.
My guess for next year is 252 figs. You're going to have to call me and tell me how close we got, okay?
I certainly will, and I listen to you every weekend.
All right. Well, thank you, Sal. Good luck, sir.
Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Louise, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Hi. It's great to talk with you.
It's good to talk to you, Louise. How are you?
I'm doing okay today.
And where is Louise doing okay?
I'm in Exeter Township near Reading in Birdsboro.
Oh, okay. Near Reading, Pennsylvania, home of the...
Yeah, right behind the Daniel Boone Homestead.
Oh, okay. Very good. What can we do for Louise near Reading?
Well, I've been hearing you talking about the mulching of the leaves and putting them on your garden, which I did that, and I've got about a foot thick of chopped up leaves on top of my garden. I was wondering if I should cover that with a tarp or just let them lay there.
Well, what kind of a garden are we talking about here?
Oh, it's not very big. It's maybe 20, not even 20 foot square. But ever since I've moved up here, I haven't had too good a luck. And I do have a lot of ants. But and I tried some llama manure one year.
Ah.
But this past year, nothing, not one seed came up.
Really? Okay, so we're talking about a summertime garden, and we're talking about a flat ground garden.
Yes. And it's just, you know, for Swiss chard, kale, tomatoes, string beans, peas, stuff like that.
Well, you know, and you've only fed it once, right? And you fed it with llama manure, which is a very slow-release fertilizer.
Yeah, because there's a llama farm down the road.
Right. See, here's what I would suggest. When the weather warms up, I really would like you to experiment with one raised bed. Just go out, and you might even have some field stone around or get some pavers or get some naturally rot-resistant wood and just build a box that's 8 feet by 4 feet.
Okay, that's about the size of my compost box.
Exactly. And put that down on top of your existing soil. And if you're going to till up the soil you have there, after you're done tilling, I would lay down sheets of newspaper to prevent the weeds from coming up that the tilling causes. But otherwise, I would just urge you to fill that box with a mixture of good quality compost and screened black high-quality topsoil and make it about, you know, so anywhere between 6 inches and a foot high. You will find that your gardening success will triple once you start growing above ground in raised bed. Flat earth gardening is, it just won't work very well. Now,
and it's all stone up this way. I'm near Stonetown, so Stonersville.
Ha! Stonetown. Yeah, that should tell you, that tells you what your soil is like, right?
With the leaves, though, do I just let them lay on top of the ground, or?
Well, right now, what I would say, a foot of mulch is too deep. It's going to prevent rainwater from hitting the soil. But you don't have anything growing in the soil. You're not really protecting the soil. See, you know, you have two choices. Either you can rake all those leaves together into a big pile, and the bottom will become compost by by the spring, or you could just leave it there. Now, you say you got llama manure from a local farm. Can you get more?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they have tons of it. They have hundreds of alpaca, it is.
Right. Well, what's the difference? I have no idea.
Yeah, llamas are bigger. Alpaca is a little bit smaller, okay. And they're more durable, I think.
Well, what I would do is I would, instead of spreading these leaves out, I would make them into a big pile. Ideally, where you're going to build the raised bed, and as you're building this pile, are the leaves shredded?
Yes.
Okay, good. As you're building this pile, mix in copious amounts of the llama manure.
Okay.
And then when you're ready to build this raised bed in the spring, the whole bottom of that pile will probably be pure compost and a very rich, loose, friable soil.
That's what I'm hoping for. I do have a big ant problem here.
Now, you say, and you think the ants are eating the seeds you put out?
Well, I heard you say play that on one of your shows, and, I mean, I have ants in the house. There's little teeny-weeny ants, and they're everywhere.
Ants and termites are the most numerous creatures on the planet. I mean, there's more ants and more termites than we can wrap our heads around. So everybody has ants. It's just a question of whether you see them or acknowledge them. Now, inside the house, I would recommend you buy boric acid bait traps and put them around where you see ants, but then don't harm the ants. Because what happens is there's little colonies. Each colony has a queen, and the queen can pump out more workers than you can ever stop. So you put out the boric acid bait traps. They take this very slow-acting poison that is relatively harmless to us. It's poisonous to ants. They take it back and feed it to the queen, and it's still another week before any of the ants get sick. But then they all get sick, and the queen dies. And that's the way to wipe them out, is you trick them into taking this substance they can't tolerate back to their nest. And next year, what I would do is I would just get a tiny little seed starting set up inside, you know, get a nice bag of seed starting soil. And when you're getting ready to start your greens and everything, I would start them in a little seed starting setup in the, just in the warmth of your house. And then after they're up and growing, even for a few days, I would transplant them outside. And that would prevent the ants from going for the seeds. That's really what ants do, is they are seed thieves.
Yeah. Oh, that's good information. Thank you so much.
Okay. Good luck, Louise.
Oh, thank you so much. I love your show. I just love it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Last cut before winter, how low should you mow? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's intriguing question.
Sure, Mike. Jim in Bethel Township, 15 miles north of Dayton, Ohio, writes, "It's almost time to take the mower deck off the tractor and replace it with the plow. And I have a question that I don't believe you've addressed in your lawn care articles. Should I cut my lawn, predominantly fescue with some bluegrass, a little shorter than normal when I cut it for the last time? I typically cut my grass at 4 inches. Should I cut it at, say, 2 3/4 or 3 inches for the last cut? The reason I ask is the grass often continues to grow after the last cut and may reach 5 to 7 inches in height before it stops. When this happens, the grass becomes matted down from the snow. Part of my concern is that it looks unkept. I can live with that if the grass is healthy, but some areas look yellow and seem slower to green up in the spring. Thanks for any advice you can give. I really enjoy listening to your show on WYSO out of Yellow Springs, Ohio."
Well, thanks, Jim. Now, the advice in State Extension System bulletins on late-season lawn height seems to be all over the place. But on closer inspection, I noticed that most of the states that were advising a low cut for the last cut were also advising what I consider to be way too many feedings over the course of the season. Some were even advising a July feeding for cool-season lawns, which is death on a stick to the poor grass.
So you think he shouldn't change his cutting height?
Well, actually, I think he should wiggle it down a little bit. But all year long, not just in the fall, a 3-inch cut is ideal for cool season grasses like his fescue and Kentucky Blue. Having those 3 inches of green allows the lawn to maximize its photosynthesis. Cut it lower than that, and the grass begins to use up more nutrients to grow faster and regain that missing height, at the expense of the underground root growth that's going to keep weeds at bay. And 3 inches is the perfect height for shading the soil surface from hot summer sun.
So wouldn't longer be even better?
No, because once it gets too tall, the grass, like he says, is going to begin to mat down and shade itself. Then you invite disease to move in, especially in a wet season.
Okay, like when perennials get too crowded inside.
Exactly. Lawns need good airflow just like other plants. And if he's following the 1/3 rule, his, quote, 4-inch grass is actually around 5.5 inches tall by the time he gets around to cutting it again.
The 1/3 rule?
Oh, yeah. That's lawn care 101. Never remove more than one-third of the total height in any one cutting. So let's say you suddenly awake after aliens have had you trapped in a time-warping alternate dimension and your lawn is now 7 inches high. You should only cut 1.5 to 2 inches off the top, then wait several days to a week, and then cut it again. You shouldn't shock the grass by cutting off too much at once.
Trapped by aliens, huh?
Yeah, happens to me all the time. Anyway, our chief lawn care advisor, Iowa State turf grass professor Nick Christians, warns against lowering the cutting height at any time of year, spring or fall. The answer to late fall growth, he says, is to keep cutting until the grass stops growing.
So you wouldn't go down to 2.5 inches if you were sure that it was only going to grow another half inch.
Ha! No, you do that and boom, guaranteed a hard winter hits fast with freezing cold temperatures but no snow. And now your little bit too low lawn is suffering frost damage and surface desiccation.
Right, because cold weather without snow cover is the most stressful winter combination for plants.
You got it. Safe lawn advocate Paul Tukey, author of the Organic Lawn Care Manual, also agrees with keeping cool season lawns cut at 3 inches going into the winter. And he's a real voice of authority here, as he spent most of his life maintaining and researching lawns in New England, where there's a high risk of winter turf problems like our listeners' snow mold. He also notes that he's rarely seen the yellowing and matting that indicates snow mold on lawns that were fed organically. And Nick Christians warns that the problem is worse on lawns that are overfed in the fall, because it's harder for them to stop growing.
That makes sense. But what about our one-tractor lawn owner?
Well, the bottom line is he should keep cutting until the grass stops growing. So my real-world advice here is either to delay changing over to that plow, or to get the tractor ready to push snow, but arrange to have a nearby mower ready for a last-minute loan. And perhaps feed the lawn a bit more gently and or earlier next fall to slow down that late season growth. Well, that sure was some good information about making the last cut of the season now, wasn't it? Luckily for those of you who want more details, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to scalp me with a brush cut if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired report, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please tell us where you live. Please, please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org. where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Adam Stanishevsky. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and see what's new every day at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our well-cut staff includes editor Al Banks, production assistant Effie Kong, and Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your moldy old host, Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. Winter's either on the way or in full swing. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how you can protect your plants from de-icers without falling on your tuchus, plus your fabulous phone calls.